So we are broadcasting live. This is Labor Radio on the Off the Hour News Collective from Ottawa. This is the People's Social Forum. Do we want to do a quick go around of who's here in studio with us?
Alberta, Rennie from Montreal, Project Genesis.
Welcome.
And I'm Susan. I'm also from Project Genesis in Montreal and CKUT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm Rosemary Wally. I'm from CKUT, Older Women Live.
Great. And our first guest that we have today is Sylvain Lapointe from the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. So would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're doing today at the Social Forum?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a postal worker, first of all. Got in the post office 36 years ago. Struggle today. Always a struggle, especially when the Conservatives are in power. But essentially what we're doing here is to make our cause known, but also support the labor movement as a whole.
Okay, great. And I heard that you have a counter proposal that you would like to make about what to do with the Canadian Postal Service.
Yeah, I think the first thing we have to do is break a myth. The myth that Canada Post costs money to the population. For the past 19 years, out of 19 years, 17 years, Canada Post was profitable and gave back to the government $1.5 billion. So that's the first myth. They say that we lose money. We do not lose money. So go from there. But they say that first-class mail is going down, and that's a fact. We can't deny first-class mail is going down with the internet. That's factual. However, the solution, if the first-class mail is going down, is certainly not to bleed the population by raising the price of the stamp by 59%. And by reducing services. Our plan is different than the corporation or the Harper government. Our plan is to bring more services to the population instead of reducing them. Services that other postal administration understood a while back that it was profitable. So, and one of those examples is banking services. But not just banking services to bleed the population, but a banking service that is close to the population and that gives access to a bank account to 900,000 Canadians and Quebecers do not have a bank account. So bring them a bank account. Give them a system that won't bleed them, won't take advantage of the most vulnerable people.
Wow, can you explain that to me a little bit more, how that would work, Canada Post to be running a banking system of some kind?
Well, first of all, until the end of the 60s, Canada Post had a bank for over 100 years. So it's nothing new. The legislation permits it. But take, for example, other countries. You have, New Zealand, that has the nice name bank, Kiwi Bank. But France is a very good example. In France, anybody can get a bank account. Mm-hmm. So you have no money, you get a bank account. So it's just like any other bank. You would go to the counter, and we already do financial transactions. We sell stamps, we sell money orders, money transfers. So we're already in the business somewhat. But what we're saying is that we could be like a bank and have bank accounts and make loans and credit cards. Guess what? President's Choice has a bank. They have credit cards. But the government will tell you that Canada Post can't do it.
Mm-hmm. That's such an interesting proposition, because one thing we've seen is some of the people who depend the most on door-to-door mail service are people who are low income, people who are having a back and forth with the Canadian government about their OAS pension application, or getting letters from the welfare office, people who are writing letters to their landlord regarding rent increases or molds. And so these people are extremely punished when the price of a stamp goes up $1, or if they are unable to get mail at their house. So it's an interesting proposal.
Well, it's an interesting way of seeing a business. Because let's say my product is hard to sell, mm-hmm. I'll raise the price.
Yeah,
that makes no sense in the business world. It makes no sense at Canada Post either.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's the most vulnerable people. And the population is getting older, and people need those proximity services. The letter carrier, one of our letter carriers did an interview, and I found really true what he said, is that the letter carrier is sometimes the extension of family. It's like family extension to the population. Sometimes it's the only person they see in their life.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other comments or questions over there?
Yes, you know, Dave, the reforms that Canada Post has been doing, they've kind of come out of left field. I was wondering, first of all, did they ever do a study before they decided that, you know, that they wanted to eliminate home delivery? And why not just reduce delivery days?
Okay, Canada Post, to justify the end of the door-to-door delivery, is basing themselves on a report that they ordered from so they ordered a study, but on that body sits the president of Canada Post. And they started, and they said that in 2020, Canada Post would lose $1 billion a year. But they started from 2012. They say in 2012, they lost $250 million. So they'll lose $1 billion in 2020. But we made profit. We made $100 million profit in 2012. So it's all full of errors and ordered by the Deepak Chopra, who's the president of the company. So there's no study. They made no study. And right now, the introduction of door-to-door is chaotic. It is in my own community, Repentigny in Quebec, where first location that was announced, and the boxes are now installed. Population don't know where they go pick up their mail, or what will happen. It's completely out of whack.
And, you know, if they could just give us reduced delivery days, maybe that would be better than getting rid of it, do you think?
That's a normal reaction to think that. But to go to alternate day delivery just kills you with the competition. Competition is out there every day. You need to be out there every day. And in fact, the big demand right now is same-day delivery.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. And we wish you a very good People's Social Forum. And hopefully we'll see you in the future. Do you have any workshops or anything you want to announce?
There is one tomorrow afternoon. There was one on banking services this morning. One on banking services this morning already happened. And tomorrow afternoon, there is one on the postal service.
Great.
So everybody is welcome, of course, to join us. And thank you for having us and feeling concerned about this.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Sylvain Lapointe from the Canadian Union of Postal Workers here at the People's Social Forum. Next up, we have Rosemary from the Older Women Live Collective. So can we ask you a question? First off, how did you have a workshop this morning? How did that go?
Our workshop this morning went very, very well. This is an issue that is extremely important. It's the issue of ageism in our society. And ageism has never been taken terribly seriously. It's always been sort of seen as part of the labour movement or part of the women's movement. But in fact, it's a discrimination all of its own.
Okay, so were there many people at your
Well, there were not. There were about 7 or 8 people. They were very, very engaged, and we had a very, very good discussion afterwards. I think single old women living alone make up a very, very large percentage of those living under poverty here in Canada. Amongst them, we have, of course, the usual people, the people that were poor before they retired. The native people, immigrant people, women of colour, women with disabilities. And don't forget, I think it's very, very important that we mention that women in full-time jobs, even today, only earn 71 cents of what men earn. So women are going to be poorer anyway in their old age. And because of family responsibilities, women don't get to work as long, so their pensions are even lower. But I think the main thing is that we have to look at the issue of pensions really as a time bomb waiting to go off. Now, so far, my generation, I'm well over 65. In fact, I've had my 70 already. But we at least did get pensions. We had the CPP. We had the old age pension. Those of us that worked in the public sector, and that was many women. We were nurses. We were teachers. We worked in government offices, in CLSCs, etc. We have public sector pensions. And then there were private pensions. If you cleaned airplanes for Air Canada, you got a pension. Well, now these pensions are disappearing completely. With the jobs, the pensions are disappearing as well. And those that do have pensions that are based on their contributions. So this is a kind of RRSP / casino system, whereby if you pay in $5 now at the age of 30, when you are 65, if you are lucky, maybe you will get your $5 back, maybe it will be $10 by then, or maybe it will have disappeared entirely, depending upon how it was invested. So there is no security at all for people if you have this kind of pension system. And of course, the young people, they're not thinking in terms of their pensions. Now, our generation, we had pensions based upon years of service. So that is far more, that's given us security. First of all, we had jobs. Everybody my age had a job. We were able to live on reasonable salaries all those years. And people acquired a certain number of assets. Many people got houses or whatever. But this situation is dramatically changing for the next generation.
Alberta, do you have anything you might want to say about pensions? I remember you're quite interested in pensions yourself.
Yes. Speaking about older women, seniors, many work like in the years when they were working, they worked like a paycheck to paycheck.
Yes, they did.
And wasn't able to have RRSPs and any investment and, you know, things that will bring them extra money. So when they retire, they just get the basic pension until they get
the guaranteed income supplement.
And with the provincial government, it depends on what you put in is what you get. So
absolutely.
What I find is that a lot of seniors, women, live in poverty, even though they receive these pensions.
Well, they are. They're living in poverty now because of the dramatic change in the relationship between what things cost and what we earn or have as pensions. That's now it used to be that there was a relationship between that, whereas now, I mean, look at the cost of hydro, you look at the cost of rent, you look at the cost of food, and even if you have worked every single day of your life, Alberta, and you have never had a day off, and you get full CPP,
right,
and you get your old age pension, or you get the top up, you are looking at $1,500 a month. And that's difficult to live on now, and imagine that in the future if they were to get that. This is without one day off in 35 years.
And I think that's why we have seniors that are staying and depressed, and they don't want, they cannot go out for that matter. Even if a friend invite them out for lunch, some seniors, they are ashamed to say, "Well, I have no money."
Exactly. I think that you're touching on a larger issue, and that is the issue of lack of respect and lack of dignity and lack of value. We are considered worthless in our old age.
Yeah.
We're never correct. You know, there's this whole anti-wrinkle culture. We are not allowed to be vulnerable. We're not allowed to have needs.
You know, that makes me think of the stereotype that we see in the media very often about older people, but most especially older women, you know, that they're grouchy and maybe a bit foolish. And contrast that with the image of older people, and including women in the native culture, where an elder is, is seen as somebody to respect and who is a resource in the community, who can contribute the benefit of their experience in life. And
well, I mean, we can just look at what society is like without the leadership, the natural leadership of old people. We've had a lot of experience in life, and as you say, in the native communities, those women are the glue of their communities, and we should be, and we have to somehow get our place back. But when you look at, there's this whole anti-wrinkle culture, you know, in the media they promote this, the exceptional woman, the woman that can cycle to the moon. Well, you see there are pages and pages about her in the media, and she's on YouTube and everything like that. This is the exception. But what this does is that it tells you that you haven't been jigging around enough in the gym, because you can't do that. And so you are vulnerable and you're responsible. It's your fault if you can't do those things. And you are the one that should be paying for all these services that you need. And that's a false message and a dangerous one.
Yeah. And another thing I think seniors face too, when you go to a doctor and you have a pain nagging you for some time, they seem to tell you, because you're old, why you have to bear with this pain.
Well, yes, there's the whole myth of old people. We're non-productive, we're burdens, we're neurotic. Of course, we have no sex lives. We don't need any kind of physical intimacy. This is what they say. This is all such nonsense.
Yes, yes.
And as you say, when you go to the doctor, they just look at you because of the ageism, which is the discrimination. They look at you, they say, this is some old dear, some sweet old dear, because there's the whole sexism around the language. And they give you a prescription and they say, go away. So we're not taken seriously. We have to fight for our place in our societies and in our communities.
Great. Thank you very much. Do you have any other comments or questions? No? Do you have any comments you want to make about this issue?
Well, I think it's a very important issue, particularly on the question of pensions and what are people going to do? There's all kinds of looming problems. My grandmother had to be put into a home. She unfortunately just slid, mental health very badly. If her husband hadn't worked at a unionized steel mill, my mother and my father probably would have had to sell their house to put her in there, and now I've had to put my mom in a home because she's fully capable, but she has some bad days, and there's no health care for her because she didn't have a physical ailment. It was a mental ailment. It's all on the family. So if I didn't have a job that, I don't make a lot of money, but if I didn't have a job that kept my head above water, so you can see the whole drive that, just because there was one pension 30 years ago in our family, we're afloat now. So you can imagine what is going to happen to people of my generation as they get older, because their kids are going to still are going to be 70 paying off their university debt.
Absolutely. But even if we go back to your grandmother may have not had a job. It was your grandfather. But your grandmother got up every day and she worked.
Five kids.
She worked her head off with those five kids. But that's not recognized by under our pension system at all.
Yeah. This is a good segue into the interview with you. Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
My name's Rich Wyman. I work for the Justice for Janitors campaign in Toronto.
And you're a superhero because you're just covered in water. There's a huge downpour has occurred while we've been doing this radio emission.
It's been very humid, so it's actually a little refreshing.
Yeah. So we're broadcasting live here on the UCU Terrace at the People's Social Forum. And maybe you could talk to us a little bit about the Justice for Janitors campaign.
Well, it's a campaign that a union, the Service Employees International Union, the local I work for, Local 2, started in Canada. Sort of based upon stuff that janitors and cleaning workers in property services, cleaning buildings and stuff had done in the United States. And there was a real problem in Canada where a majority of these workers were either getting minimum wage or less than minimum wage because employers would trap them in subcontracting arrangements, trick them to start their own company, which would mean if they fell and hurt themselves on the job, they were just let go. Very horrible conditions. And working in buildings owned by some of the wealthiest people, Brookfields, Cadillac Fairviews, the banks, all these places with billions of dollars of assets, paying people, primarily immigrants, primarily women, next to nothing and treating them like dirt. So we looked at a strategy to try to figure out how to organize those workers. The traditional strategy had been one building at a time. The problem is because the industry is based on competitive bidding, it meant that the minute you start to push wages up, another company would come in and tell the property owner, I can do it for less. And then because of Mike Harris's wonderful anti-union laws, it meant that those workers didn't get to keep their union. So they had to reunionize, and the new company didn't actually have to hire everybody. Mm. So, of course, they would bring in their family, break the union, and then... So we looked at what they'd done in the United States, which was trying to organize companies on a geographic basis. So we looked at all, going after targeting the big companies in Toronto and saying, all your buildings in Toronto will be part of a union drive. Mm. Big buildings, small buildings. So we were able to do that, and now we've started to do that. We started that about 6 years ago, or 5 years ago, sorry, in Ottawa. And next year we go in to negotiate with 15 different companies for 2,700 workers in Ottawa. And the big fight will be to try to get these part-time workers some benefits for them and their families, because the majority of these workers have no benefits at all.
Okay, it must be so challenging to organize people who may be officially autonomous workers. So how do you approach that angle in your organizing?
Well, fortunately, the biggest problem isn't that, because most of those people are quite angry they're stuck in that situation. There are provincial laws that, strangely enough, there's very few good labor laws in Ontario, but one of them is that there are people called dependent employees, dependent contractors. So taxi drivers have been able to form unions even though they're independent contractors. The labor board has a favorable view that says if you're using the equipment, if you don't have advertising, if you don't really have an address in the phone book, you're not really a company. You actually are totally dependent on this employer for all your income. So we've been able to overcome that. The bigger problems are overcoming, trying to organize 700 workers in 70 buildings, working three shifts, speaking 15 languages, people with varying different statuses, you know, from having status but not wanting to use, you know, both names. They use two names, to people on temporary foreign worker permits, to people with no status, all these sorts of problems that, you know, employers whip up and create fear and division amongst the workforce on. So, but, you know, I think when we talk to people and talk to them about what is possible if they come together, it takes a lot of time. But if you can get people angry about the issues they know that and the problems they have, our motto is sort of anger can overcome fear, and that hope, if you give people a hope that there's a, you know, a possibility for something better, that that sustains the anger and cuts against the attempt by employers to sort of scaremonger amongst mm-hmm. workers.
Can you give us some examples of some successful organizing, like some improvements to people's working conditions?
Well, in Toronto last year, we were able to negotiate for anybody working 25 hours or more, the beginnings of some basic, actually that we'd got them benefits in a previous contract, but we got them the beginnings of dental care, which is extremely rare for part-time employees. It's not the greatest dental plan, but it was, you know, we had, I think, about 400 people come out to a meeting to talk about how to use it. And it was the most ecstatic meeting of a group of poor, hardworking immigrant workers I'd ever seen. Just the fact that they would mm-hmm. be, their kids would be able to get their teeth cleaned mm-hmm. and it wouldn't cost them literally a month's worth of wages. So it seems like a small improvement, but it's actually, what it's meant is people don't quit their job as quickly now to try to find something better. They actually, it's created a problem for the employers now because people now get better vacation pay because they're sticking around yeah. longer. So there's small improvements like that. In Alberta, we were able to organize workers out in an oil patch, cleaners out there for a company. It was a very hard campaign, but they actually got dramatic wage increases, better turnaround pay, i.e. pay when they leave and when they come back and things like that. So there's been successes like that.
And dental care is really just such a huge, huge, huge issue. The fact that it's privatized, I mean, there's so many people without access to dental care, and that's a great win for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Susan, did you have some questions you wanted to ask as well?
Yes, I did. You know, I'm just wondering, in general, as a member of the public, is there anything I can do to help you in your struggle? And maybe more specifically, what can I ask my local MNA or MP to do to help?
Well, strangely, being from Montreal, you guys have the most unique situation in all of Canada, where there is there's a thing called the Tripartite Commission, which is sort of like a union of employers, like an employers group, the SEIU local in Quebec, and the government that sets a separate, distinct minimum wage for cleaners. And of course, the union negotiates over and above that for pensions, RRSPs, sick days, and things like that for cleaners. But the minimum wage, I think, in Quebec for most cleaners is $15.25. And it's going up, I think, over the next 3 or 4 years to almost $16, which is unheard of. We're still struggling to get people past the $13 mark in Toronto. And in Ottawa, we're still struggling to get people past the $12 mark. So for us, the threshold is to look at Quebec. So anything there, if the government attempts to pull that tripartite commission apart, obviously. But in anybody in the Ottawa region or the Gatineau region, Outaouais, it's the federal government's the largest property owner here. And they love to award contracts to non-union, you know, malicious little companies constantly trying to undermine the gains, the small gains that workers here have made. So keeping your eyes open, if you see demonstrations or you hear of something in the news, call property owners. Because the reason property owners contract out the cleaners is so they don't have to think about them. And so when we're able to use, you know, abusive cleaners and stuff like that to embarrass large banks and things like that, they usually very rapidly say, we don't want to be in the news because a company we contracted out has abused a worker. Could just fix this right away. So putting public pressure on institutions is quite often very important.
Great. Thank you so much. Did you have a question, Rosemary?
Yeah, sure. Can I ask you a question about this whole aspect of subcontracting and employing undocumented people? Do you have a problem with that in Toronto?
There used to be a large problem. When we organized groups that already had subcontractors, we didn't want to drive people who didn't have status or documentation out.
Exactly.
So what we said was, as long as subcontractors paid union dues, received benefits under whatever name, we close our eyes. And as long as that those workers were not being used by an employer to drive down standards, it's not our business what status people have. Our union's position, if you're good enough to work here, you're good enough to be defended by the union regardless of your status. And we know that there's all kinds of tricky things in there. It's meant that there's been a real reduction of subcontracting in Toronto because of that. And, you know, people use whatever methods they have to go to work, and we aren't, you know, we defend their rights regardless of their status in the workplace. That's our key thing, is to raise everybody up and not allow employers to abuse people's precarious situations to drive standards down.
Great. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you, Rich, and also thank you, Rosemary.
Thank you.
We're listening to People's Radio. I think it's 107.1 if you're tuned in around the University of Ottawa, and CKUT 90.3. We're doing a broadcast there as well. So I think we're going to go to some music now. And great. Thank you very much.
Sorry. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Welcome back. You're listening to Labor Radio live from the People's Social Forum. You can tune in on People's Radio 107.1 if you're in the Ottawa area, or 90.3 if you're on CKUT, or check out the archives, ckut.ca. So we're here with Herman Rosenfeld from the Free Accessible Transit Campaign. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the campaign?
Yes, it's it was originally started by an organization called the Greater Toronto Workers Assembly, which was a coming together of left people, people who were from anti-poverty groups, from social social movements, the idea of building a more militant class-wide fight back. And we decided, we looked at what kind of campaigns do we want to do. And after a few months of winnowing, we talked about the idea of fighting to argue that transit, public transit, should not be the subject of a user fee or fares. It should be seen as a right, like medical care, a social right, like medical care. People had a fight for that one too, if you remember correctly. Libraries, public education, something that should be seen as a collective consumption item, something that, and obviously, if free transit, there's a number of implications. If you didn't have fares, it wasn't, not as if it wouldn't be paid for, it'd be paid for collectively. Then it would mean that it would massive increase in users, have to be restructured, a whole series of things.
Albert, I think you had a question you wanted to ask.
I would like to know, what strategies do you use in your campaign to accomplish that the transit company conform to free and accessible ridership?
Well, we know that this is a long-term demand, because it implies massive increase in funding through taxes, raising taxes in an era where taxes are not taxes are poisonous. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it means an end to an austerity argument where people argue, well, we have to do with less. It means a drastic reduction in the specific weight of private auto transport and subsidies that go to auto users and highways. And there's a housing patterns around that, and it means other forms of funding in terms of controlling the banks, a whole series of changes. And of course, the big one is how people look at the world, how transit users, how people see their rights, and how people see collective versus individual rights. So what our strategy has been, originally what we did is we went on subways. We just went on. We paid our fares, went on subways, and we did street theater. And, you know, we'd have a dialogue across the subway car. And then we start talking to people one by one about free transit. We do education around it. And we did that for a while, and we got a number of people interested, but we didn't necessarily have huge ranks. What we realized that what was missing was also a mass transit movement of ordinary working people around things which are shorter-term demands, things like more transit, transit in our neighborhoods, and lowering fares as a way of moving towards free fares. And so at the same time, what we did is we started working with a group of other activists to build a mass transit movement called the TTC Riders. TTC stands for the Toronto Transit Commission. And this group existed, but it was mostly just on paper. It was, and the idea was a number of activists figured we're going to try and build this from our campaign, but also other transit activists, build this as a way of making transit affordable, more accessible, and accessible in terms of for people with disabilities, but also in terms of they can afford to pay, that it's in their neighborhoods, and that things like bunching buses and, you know, that you have to wait an hour for, and then suddenly three come and two of them are filled, that sort of thing, that could be changed, that could be transformed. And I guess the other piece that's really critical is that Toronto, unlike in Quebec and unlike most cities, you know, Toronto's the biggest city in Canada. And most major cities, the biggest city in countries where the biggest city is there, is that transit is subsidized by the next level of government in a federal system like Canada, which would be the province or the United States, the state, or the federal government. That doesn't happen in Canada, in Toronto. As of up to 1995, the province paid 50% of the operating costs of transit. That changed when we had a very strong right. I mean, Couillard is a pretty right-wing guy, but Mike Harris was even more right-wing in 1995, downloaded the costs of transit to the city, and no more subsidies, marginal subsidies. And so what happens is that has to be paid for by fares, and we want that changed. We want that. Anyway, that's a sort of thing that's happening, and we want to build. We're building a movement around that. Now, the challenge, one of the challenges, building the movement is one thing, and there are issues around whether people see they can get involved in transit, how they in transit issues. But for us, it's also how do we combine the longer term demand, the more radical demand around free transit, with getting involved in finding things in the shorter term. Do we drop that? No, we don't want to drop that. On the other hand, we want to make it have some kind of influence on the shorter term demands. Sorry.
You know, your campaign is of great interest to us in Montreal because we have a campaign on now to get a social fare, a low-cost fare for people living below the poverty line. So I'd love to know what kind of demonstrations or actions have you been finding to be effective in your campaign?
Actually, I just want to start by saying we too, at one of our demands of this TTC riders is around $700 million a year from the province to lower fares by 20%, not just freeze them, to increase service by 25%, and to have special low-income fares for people on low income, however one defines it. And one of the things that just happened at the City Council of Toronto, which is an enormously miserable body, and if you think that a right, you know, like all the stereotypes of these kinds of bodies, it applies to them. They've agreed to actually study to actually come up with a recommended policy in a tough couple of years around a low-income pass. And there are a number of, so what we've done is we work with groups like this. One group's called the Fair Fare Coalition, which is made up of people who work in social agencies who aren't hacks, but are like activists, but they're sort of trapped in them, but they're more activists, and some of the people who use those services around a low-income pass. And also, we have argued. So what have we done? We've had demonstrations. We actually had Dundas Square is a place that, you know, where they have this experiment. They had this experiment where they closed all the four corners, so, you know, as part of the rotation of the red lights and green lights. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we had this mock subway car, and we actually went through this and every time, and we demanded that they have free fares on hot days and cold, you know, like the cold days, and a low income pass. We have demonstrations around to demand of the provincial government, you know, a number of different kinds of demands. We had these sardine costumes that we don't want to be tired to be packed by sardines, and we've engaged the Toronto Transit, the union of the subway drivers and the maintenance people to join us in these demands. And in fact, the day that the election was called, we had a rally at Queen's Park. It was the day after. There wasn't that many people there, but the demonstrators were there. So this is the kind of thing. Plus, we lobby, you know, city politicians. But the main thing is to try and get a base amongst the population, the working class population of Toronto, particularly in different communities that are ill served by transit, to get them to develop chapters. So we actually have a mass-based transit, or rather than just us acting as spokespeople for people, which is usually, we try to build a base. And, you know, around transit issues, it's funny, it's like people, it's the first thing that people complain about because, you know, it affects they're getting to work or they're getting, for low-income people, it's not, you know, even if whether you get work or not.
It affects, whether you can go and look for work.
Where you can look for work, but it's also, it affects whether, if you have work, it's even more. It's whether you go shopping. You know, if you're a single mom, you got to take your kids, you got to take them to recreation, to the doctor. And in Toronto, we don't even have like a transfer. You have transfers, but you got to go right away, you know. So one of the demands has been, in the short run, is to have like a 2 or 3 hour transfer period where you can do your business and stuff. But so all of these things are things we've been involved with in terms of mass demonstrations, in terms of education, and in terms of building allies among, this, you know, all of the, you know, like the anti-poverty groups. But also there's a whole group of people working in social agencies, even in the city government. There are certain levels of the bureaucracy who've actually, like the health department. They've this one particular woman in the health department, she pushed that. They have these little pamphlets explaining about the situation of low-income people. So right now, I guess the issue for us right now is to push on what the character of those low-income passes are going to be. You know, should they be for everybody who's on social assistance or, you know, on disability? Should they be people who are unemployed as well? Right, on unemployment insurance, should they be simple? What's the percentage of the cost? Should they be? We're arguing that it should be a pass where you can use it like a metro pass, where you can use it to go anywhere at any time, you know, without any restrictions, things like should it be 50% of the cost of the regular passes? Should it be less? Should it be only? These are things we're arguing with, and we're doing it by consulting with the people involved.
What's the reaction of the TTC administration? Because in Montreal, our equivalent of the TTC is the STM, and they're extremely closed to this idea. One reason they give is actually ridership is so high, the buses are full, the metro is full. They would prefer it if people stayed home in some ways. So we've had a huge blockade with the STM. We did get the City Hall to tell them to do a study. The STM is refusing to do a study on the social fare, and the mayor even had made during the election campaign and made a promise to have a social fare within 90 days of being elected. Of course, he broke that promise. So I'm just curious about the TTC in Toronto. How are they approaching your movement and your demands?
Around the free transit, they think we're nuts. They won't even consider it. Although we have a good, the mass-based group, the TTC riders, we have a very good working relationship with the head of the TTC and some of his accolades. They're actually quite cooperative in the low-income fare. In stopping this increasing fares completely and in getting more money for mm-hmm. transit, but both the TTC staff and the transit union, both of them are very they think the free transit's a pipe dream for them because it requires fundamental change in terms of how we see austerity, taxes. Those kinds of things, and that's one of the reasons why we call for the free transit because we actually want those changes. We're socialists, you know, mm-hmm. and active, and so it means that it has to do with breaking some of the power of the real estate and financial interests, which drive the economy of a city like Toronto and the neoliberal sort of economy we have today. But as far as the low-income passes, there seems to be a lot. The TTC has basically said, we think this is fair. We'd like to see it, but we're not in the social, we're not in the social welfare business.
That's exactly what the STM said. That's the exact.
Well, they probably talk to each other. Yeah. But if we get the money, we wouldn't be opposed to it. Yeah.
So, but they have a lower fare for seniors and they have a lower fare for students. So it's like they do. Those are anyways.
The history in Toronto mm-hmm. has been that transit has been seen as it's too expensive. People should have to pay and a second fiddle to cars. And it has a lot to do with, you remember Toronto, like Montreal, is now amalgamated. So it means that a lot of the former suburbs are now part of the city. And those people live in places where they have to drive. So this creates social conflicts, which can only be resolved by providing public transit, dealing with urban sprawl, and then hammering, the cost of cars, like raising gas prices, raising the gas tax, raising other kinds of taxes, and shaping the idea that, that for the environment, but also for the living for people, that you have to change the shape of the way we live.
Are there any other questions, Susan or Alberta, that you have?
What I think in Montreal, they try to encourage ridership, telling people to leave their vehicles at home and use the transit system. But that's the same thing. They're not lowering the fares. They seem to be raising it all the time. But what I think, if they lower the fares, I think they'll have more people leaving the cars at home and riding the buses and trains.
I think you're 100%. I'm in the same boat as you are, sister. And, Alberta, I think it makes perfect sense what you're saying. And the point is that it takes an activist movement to actually raise this notion that we have that transit has to be seen like other social services, and we're not just we're not customers, although because they think this is as a monetary transaction. Mm-hmm. And on one level, there is a certain monetary trail. We want to lessen the specific weight of that kind of relationship and make this to become a social right. Mm-hmm. And that means paying. That means we're increasing taxes. And in this tax averse era, where this is seen as heresy, because everything is seen as what you can buy as an individual or. We have to change it. So this is partly changing this. And it has to do with the benefits of public transit. And it means that people who are currently using cars, not only will, in terms of the cost, but also in terms of the availability of public transit.
Do you want to say something, Susan? I saw you.
Yeah, I'm just totally agreeing with what you're saying. And I liked the specific things that you talked about in detail about the elements of pushing for a social fare. Yeah, I found that very interesting.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today. That was really wonderful. We're listening to People's Radio. This is we're broadcasting from the Social Forum. You can listen to us at 107.1 FM. And also, we'll be back tomorrow from 5 to 6. We'll be doing an anti-colonial radio hour. So thank you very much for coming and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. No problem. My pleasure.
Great.
It was great to meet you.
Well, nice to meet you, too.
I would like you to actually contact. I mean, could we contact? Because we'd like to keep contact with a sister movement that's happening in another city.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. We're here to build alliances. That's what the forum is all about.
And if I only had my damn backpack, which I left somewhere because I went to the march, I would give you some of our materials. And
oh, that would be great. We definitely love to.
I'm going to be here until Saturday afternoon so I can do it. You guys going to be here tomorrow, too?
Yeah, for sure.
You're the panel?
Well,
that's good.
We're working hard here tomorrow. That's all I know.
I'll come by with some materials.
That would be
maybe
great.
Maybe exchange contacts, because the fact that there's this movement is very—it's very important to hear this. So.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think Alberta, you wanted to talk a little bit about a workshop you had been to today.
Okay. Yes. I happened to bump into a workshop. I was looking for one workshop, which I didn't find. So I bumped into another one part of the way. But what I gathered from it is that it says that, and I agree with what was being said, that there's an air of supremacy by our government that does not recognize that all people are equal. Hence the reason they turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to the importance that all people should be economically capable to support themselves and families. Poverty can be wiped out if they share the wealth. A quote that caught me, which the lady spoke and said, "The slave master is paid and not the slave."
Thank you. And Susan, we also went to another workshop. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I think we're going to play an interview soon from that workshop.
Yeah, we went to an amazing workshop given by Helen Kennedy, the executive director of EGAL, which works for rights for homeless youth who from the GLBT community.
Great. And you told me that you found it very shocking, actually.
I was just blown away. You know, in my environment, in the community in Montreal that I live in, you know, gay rights are respected and the rights are being worked towards and being achieved. But I was just blown away in the workshop that homeless kids from that community are having an hugely rough time. They're grossly underserved. They're not getting government support, and EGAL is working. They're going to make it possible for the homeless gay kids in Toronto to start to get funding from the City of Toronto. But I mean, without them, there would be nothing. And her group, EGAL, has just opened a center that's funded by a person, an individual, out of the goodness of that person's heart. And by the way, a non-gay person. And you know, it's just shocking to me that how underserved they were and what a rough time they're having. It just blew me away.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We're going to go to that interview. I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Labor Radio. We're live from the Social Forum in Ottawa. Tomorrow, tune in for an anti-colonial hour from 5 to 6 p.m. So thank you very much, everyone.
My name is Helen Kennedy. I'm the executive director of EGAL Canada, Canada's LGBT human rights organization. EGAL has been in operation since 1986. We're Canada's only national LGBT human rights organization doing this work. We have a strong history in litigation in Canada. We were very involved in the same-sex marriage case. And now we focus primarily on education, training, LGBT homelessness, suicide, anything to do with building awareness and education.
Mm-hmm. And you've recently done a report, Not Under My Roof. Could you tell me a little bit about the findings of that report?
Sure. We did a study in 2012 on LGBT street homelessness and the population of homeless youth across the country, specifically addressing the needs of our LGBT homeless youth, and also looking at the percentage and the numbers of LGBT identified youth amongst the homeless population. So we found high percentage of LGBT and Two-Spirit youth, Two-Spirit being the Aboriginal term, identified in the street population. For example, in Toronto, our study showed 23% of the street youth identified as LGBTQ2S. So it's a large number currently living on the streets in downtown Toronto.
Can you identify some factors that lead LGBTQ youth to be overrepresented in the homeless population?
Yeah, when we did our focus groups with street-involved youth, the primary factor was family rejection. Most were on the street because their family did not agree with their sexual orientation or their gender identity. That was probably one of the biggest factors, was being rejected by your family. And some of the other issues were substance abuse issues, bullying at school was another factor, not being accepted by your peers. But absolutely, by far, it was the family rejection was the number one reason why our youth were on the street.
And what are some of the obstacles that prevent youth from getting off the street?
Well, currently, and I'm speaking now to Toronto, but there are other regions in the country that have similar situations. The shelter system, the shelter housing and support system within the city, is not accepting of the LGBT2S youth. They find, and they have reported this to us themselves, that they're further victimized when they go through the shelter system, whether it be by the shelter housing and support staff, or in particular, though, it's from the other residents of the facilities. So not being able to access those services, many of which bring with them services around counseling, case management, addressing some of the needs that the youth might have. When you don't feel safe in that environment, you can't access those services. So that is a huge problem for our street-involved youth.
And what about accessing social assistance benefits? Are there obstacles there that are specific to LGBT, Two-Spirit youth?
Especially for the younger youth, they don't have access to proper ID. It's not something that they've ever had to do before for themselves. A lot of the youth are find themselves without OHIP cards, they don't have driver's license, they don't have access to their documents. So for these youth and our LGBT2S youth, we've opened a crisis counseling center, and the youth can come to the counseling center. They can access help, they can access counseling. We have people who can help them to apply for the documentation that they need in order to get on to social assistance, for example, and get everything that they need in order to access these services.
And you've also opened a shelter and a group home as well?
Not yet.
Okay.
We're hoping to. The Crisis Counseling Center right now is the first step, mm-hmm. in the next step being to open a group home plus a shelter plus a transitional housing for mm-hmm. our street kids. So we're hoping to do that next year.
And have you had any support from the municipal government?
Not directly, not yet, but the City of Toronto did their own needs assessment recently, well, a couple of years ago actually, of street youth, where they identified 21% of the street youth are LGBTQ, and they also did their own needs assessment around accessing the services, and they know that our youth are not comfortable in the shelter system. So we're working with the City of Toronto and other service providers to address this need, and the city is now at the stage where they're calling for requests for expressions of interest.
Great. So we're sorry for talking a little bit over Helen Kennedy. We don't have enough time to completely finish that interview, although I think we'll let it run. If you're here in the Ottawa area, we might try to pull the rest of it on Labor Radio next month, maybe. We always do the third Thursday of the month. And we just wanted to say goodbye. So do you have any parting words?
Well, I was happy to be here and to get some information from the different people we interviewed, and to build a relationship to see that we have a better country, and like that poverty will be wiped out.
And during the show today, we actually made some new friends and built some new alliances, which is has been an amazing part of the experience here at the forum. And if you've, I don't know, if you were listening and you might be new to Labor Radio, please keep listening to us every month from now on.
Yeah, we'll be continuing to cover homelessness and transit issues and all kinds of issues affecting working poor, unemployed, and ununionized people. So thank you very much. This is Susan, Albert, and Kathy signing off for Labor Radio at the Social Forum.
I wonder if it's possible to measure any kind of a difference in the police attitudes or police actions after the training versus before you started the training.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the training that we're doing, it's a specific police training program. It's called RHBP, Report Homophobic Violence. And one of the things that is so important about this program is that we do training sessions with the police and we do training sessions with our own community, because we want people, LGBT people, to feel comfortable reporting to the police. Because often the case is that the local LGBT community service agency has different numbers and higher incidence of violence against the LGBT community than the police, because we're not comfortable to report to the police. So when we first introduced the program, following our first training session, the numbers balanced out and the police were getting the same incidence of the same, they had the same numbers of reports as our LGBT community center. So that was a positive thing. Mm-hmm. But it's up and down. You know, I know that we have to do a lot more work for our trans community members. They're still not comfortable to report incidents to the police. So we have to do a lot more work.
Mm-hmm. What about the provincial and federal governments? Are there things they could do to address or ease the problem of homelessness amongst LGBTQ?
Sure. I mean, in the way it's structured right now is that the province gives a pot of money to municipalities to address homeless issues, right? So what we would like to do is have a separate... we don't want to take away from the current system, because it's desperate for funding as well and needs to be enhanced and enriched. What we really need is a federal program, federally driven on housing and homelessness, which is not happening at the federal level. So we have to have a look at how we can deal with our federal government to get them more involved in this conversation. And we also have to look at how we can increase the amount of money from our provincial government to address the problem, whether it be from a health perspective, from an education perspective, a labor perspective. I think it's a holistic approach to this issue. If you don't have stable housing, how can you function?
Mm-hmm.